Good morning. This is Focus 580. It's hour number two of our program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for our program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frain is at the controls this morning. Well, in this second hour of the show, we'll be continuing with the theme of the morning to talk about water issues. And in this part of Focus, we'll be talking about water management and the issue of drought. And certainly it is true that drought is complicated, and it is unlike a lot of other natural disasters in that it's sometimes very difficult to determine when droughts begin or when they end. They do have widespread and dramatic impact, and certainly you can put a money figure on that. For example, in the 1990s, FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, estimated that drought cost the United States between $6 and $8 billion every year, and they say that probably that's an underestimate. We'll be talking a little bit this morning about drought, and we have two guests joining us, both by telephone. Michael Hayes, he is the director of the National Drought Mitigation Center, which is based in the School of Natural Resources at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln. He's been the director just since August, but has been involved in the work of the center there since it was created in 1995, starting as assistant professor, climate impact specialist, then associate professor, then associate director, and now he's the director. And over this time, he's been involved in research looking at drought monitoring, at impact assessment, at planning, and he has also worked with local, state, tribal, and federal officials on all of those things, on drought planning and mitigation. Also joining us is Peter Binney. He is the director of Aurora Water. This is the third largest municipal water provider in the state of Colorado. He is responsible for serving the water and other utility needs for the people who live in this eastern Denver metro suburb, 300,000 people, and he's been on the job there for the last 6 years. He's a registered professional engineer, has postgraduate engineering degrees from University of Canterbury and University of Colorado. Before taking his present position, he was a consulting engineer for 25 years, and he worked on water projects throughout the U.S., as well as projects in China, in Europe, and in South America. As we talk, questions are certainly welcome, as always. The only thing we encourage people to do is to try to be brief in their questions and comments, but we only do that because we like to try to get in as many different callers as possible. So, of course, anyone who is listening is welcome to join the conversation. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good. No matter where you're listening, if you're listening on the air around Illinois and Indiana, or maybe you might be listening on the internet, you can use the toll-free line. In any case, that is 800-222-9455. So again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Well, Dr. Hayes, hello.
Hello.
And Mr. Binney, hello.
Good morning.
I appreciate both of you giving us some of your time. Maybe I'll ask Michael Hayes, do you want to just talk for a moment or two a little bit more about the work of the National Drought Mitigation Center?
Sure. The National Drought Mitigation Center was established in 1995, so we've been around for about 12 years now. And the mission of our center is to try to help reduce societal vulnerability to drought through planning and mitigation strategies. So in other words, try to get officials and the public to think about droughts, understand droughts, and then do some activities that might reduce the vulnerability and future impacts to droughts that haven't yet occurred but will occur in the future. So that's a little bit about the center.
All right, let me ask Peter Binney. Tell us about Aurora, Colorado.
Well, we're a large water provider to, as you mentioned in your introduction, 300,000 people, and we are beneficiary of some of the work that the National Drought Center does. It's you know, they help us take a very complicated natural resource issue and convey that to our public. You know, so when we tell them that they are going to have water restrictions, you know, and that we have to invest to find additional water supplies because of the drought impacts. We use the National Drought Center and some of their outputs to convey that to the public. Unfortunately, drought is an abstraction that people don't really appreciate. It's not as pointed as a tornado or a hurricane, and it's one of those things that sits with us for many years out here. It's a continual weather condition that we have to integrate with our water management program. So, I'm sure as we go through the hour, we'll talk more about the impacts that it has had on our water system and mm-hmm. what it means to our community.
Well, let me just have one quick follow-up. Where do you get your water? What are your sources for water?
We use snow melt that comes off the Continental Divide. When you see all those pictures of people skiing out here in Colorado, that is really our water supply. It comes out of the Colorado River Basin, the Arkansas River Basin, and the South Platte, and it all comes to us in about 6 weeks during the spring runoff period of time.
Well, let me go back to Dr. Hayes, because drought is there is a very clear technical definition. Sometimes perhaps people will use the term loosely simply to describe an extended period where precipitation is less than average. What exactly, for somebody like you, for climatologist, what exactly do you mean by that word? What is a drought?
I think that's a really good question, and I guess I would answer and say that there really isn't a technical definition that you can use across the entire country or around the world, for example. It really depends where your water comes from and how you use your water. So, for example, Aurora, Colorado might have a different perspective on what drought is compared to, say, what the drought that's going on in the Southeast or water provider in the Great Lakes region, for example. So it really depends where you are. Droughts can happen all across the United States, and I think that's being proven this year, but it's locally defined, and officials need to realize that and understand what is their local perspective on drought.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose that one of the things that is true and can be very frustrating about drought is that they're self-perpetuating. Once you get into a dry cycle, you're not going to just come out of it. Chances are you're not going to come out of it just the next year.
True, and another issue with drought is there's kind of this wait-and-see attitude that is very common. So you might be experiencing a dry period, and the forecast shows that, well, it's going to rain this weekend, and so you might hold off on making some decisions until you see what happens during the weekend, and it doesn't rain, but there's rain in the forecast again, so you might hold off, or the rainy season might be approaching, say, in Florida, and so let's hold off on making some decisions until we see what's going on with that. And I think that really makes officials struggle in how to deal with drought, just because there is kind of this natural tendency to wait and see what might happen down the road.
Well, that's, I think, one of the things that your center is concerned with and that you've been involved in is trying to help people deal with drought. Are we now more and more going to have to get into a posture that says it's not we're going to think about if drought happens? We know that it will, and so we can't wait until we actually know that we're in one to start to say, and now how are we going to deal with the impacts?
That's exactly right. I think our vulnerability to drought around the country is increasing for some reasons, not necessarily climate reasons, but because of population pressures or the importance of recreation and tourism or environmental issues. And so being prepared and having a set guideline on how you're going to respond as conditions worsen in a dry period is, I think, very helpful for officials. And I think that's the tact that Aurora has followed and other municipalities and so forth around the country have kind of taken that approach, and I think that's very helpful for them.
Well, here I'll turn back to Peter Binion, and I think, Peter, that water issues are becoming more and more important all over the country, in places even where in the past they hadn't worried about them. But I think one thing that it is true that for a long time now in the West, water has been an issue. In your area, is drought always something that's kind of in the back of your mind? Does a lot of what you do revolve around at least the idea of making the most efficient use of the water that you have?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, here in Aurora, we get around 11 inches of precipitation per year. Unfortunately, most of that turns up as snow during the winter months, and it's not part of our water supply. So drought and drought resilience and how we deal with these things like we've been going through for the last 6 years, in my mind, is really the limiting factor on how these communities develop and how we operate these water systems. I mean, to go back to one of your previous questions to Michael, you know, for us, the definition of a drought is the difference between supply and demand. And we have a different supply system to downtown Denver. You know, so I can go across a street and I'll have a different definition of a drought. Denver happens to be a very old system, and so they got first use of the water around here, and they have more drought resilience than we do, and we have better drought resilience in the next suburb that is out from us. So, you know, what we all struggle with is how do we take the limited resource, and out here it's not land, it's not air, it's water. And so our adaptive management, you know, how we respond to climate variability and drought and serving our customers' needs has to be a combination of demand management and supply side that you know, is going to jump around depending on where these weather cycles go. And unfortunately, what we're going through at the moment is an extended dry period. You know, we've seen them in the past, we'll see them in the future. Everything we're seeing is that they're likely to be more severe and more protracted. And so now we've got to balance water conservation with trying to develop additional water, you know, which has got its infrastructure costs. And at least at my level, that's where the real reluctance comes from politicians, which is spending money to give you more tools in your toolkit to respond to climate variability. So, you know, we have to have a portfolio of responses that we deal with, you know, whatever nature is throwing at us. But that's what we're working through at the moment.
Yeah. And I get this, it's worth noting, I suppose, and it's not just an issue for you, that one of the things that you cannot control, in a sense that you can't control, is demand. You can get people to try to be more conscious of their use of water, but for, I'm just thinking about the fact that, for example, there in Aurora, now your population is maybe a little over 300,000. I read this article that was in the New York Times Magazine in which you were quoted, where apparently you're expecting that maybe over the next couple of decades that the population there might go up to something like 500,000 or more. So you're really looking ahead. Not only are you thinking, how am I going to supply the needs of these 300,000 people today, but how in 20 years from now I'm going to be able to supply demand for water when the population goes up to 500,000.
Right. And part of that will be demand management. I mean, we did find a way to reduce the per-person consumption by about 35% during the depths of the drought that we were in, but that was increasing the price of water by 500%. It was having water cops out on the street and in the middle of the night finding people who were trying to keep their Kentucky bluegrass green in the middle of a drought. You know, so there are ways you can reduce demand on a short-time basis, but it gets back to, you know, should we have communities which are, you know, most of our land use planning actually is very representative of what you'd have there in Illinois or in the wetter parts of the United States to the east of us. And, you know, people came out here and they thought it would be nice to have a little piece of Illinois out here, but you can't do that in you know, this semi-arid climate we have. So we're thinking about community planning, land use planning, what the water footprint is of these communities, and, you know, maybe we're going to have to change the way we build our cities in the West as a way of reducing the demand, because from a supply side, the only place that we have to turn to find additional water is to have less agriculture, irrigated agriculture out here. And that's got its own tensions built into it.
Let me just quickly introduce again both of the guests for this hour. Last for a person you heard is Peter Binney. He's director of Aurora Water. It is the third largest municipal water provider in the state of Colorado. He's responsible for serving the water needs of over 300,000 people in Aurora, which is a suburb of Denver, and has been doing that for the last 6 years. Also joining us is Michael Hayes. He is the director of the National Drought Mitigation Center. That's based in the School of Natural Resources at the University of Nebraska, Lincoln. And if you are interested, maybe I'll just mention that both these guys have websites. Their organizations have websites. So if you're interested in learning more, reading more about drought, you can go to the Drought Mitigation Center's website, and there's lots of information there. So that's drought.unl.edu. And if you would like to read about Aurora, Colorado, and about Aurora Water and what they do there, go to aurora.gov, all one word, auroragov.org, and you can find out more about them. And questions here are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We do have somebody here in our area calling in from Farmer City, so let's talk with them. This is line number one. Hello?
Yes, yeah. I got a little perspective on both places. I lived in Boulder for 10 years. I had a little farm outside in Niwot there, and now I live in Champaign. I had some cattle, and I had water shares that came out of the Boulder White Rock Reservoir. The shares, I also had some shares in a Big Thompson Reservoir up by Fort Collins. They would transfer that water down to Boulder, into the Boulder Reservoir somehow. But I never got all my shares of water. It seemed like every time I'd go to irrigate, they would... Well, you had evaporation, transfer, yada, yada. I never got all my water. So all of a sudden, the Big Thompson shares went ballistic price-wise because they were able to trade them to developers.
Mm-hmm.
So they could develop more property, of course, move more people in.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, well, you know, you're not giving me my water anyway, so I sold some of those shares. I think, and then Erie, the town of Erie, which was nothing on the map, is now a bustling little town there, I understand.
Right.
But another point of interest here is by living in Champaign and living out there, I noticed that the water in that area runs off the top. I guess the soil's pretty much clay in that area. And here, I finally understood the soil here. The soil around here is like 2 to 4 feet thick in topsoil. And it acts like, when it rains here, it acts like a sponge. And last year, they grew a corn crop here, and it didn't get but one or two small rains on the whole crop. But yet, they made, you know, a normal crop.
Uh-huh.
It acts like a wick. You know, corn wicks it out of this 2 to 4 foot sponge, whether they get hardly any rain or water on it at all, you know. If
yeah.
they get rains in the spring, it just holds, it's like a kind of like an aquifer right on top of the surface.
Yeah, unfortunately the soils out here were an old ocean bed, and it's really a sandstone underneath you, so you don't get any of that sponge effect, and if you did, that water belongs to somebody else anyway, so it's, you know, you've got a couple of things working there. One is the geology of the area. You know, secondly is the way we administer our water rights out here. You just get one use of the water, and then all that return flow that's in the sponge actually is water that's going to somebody else further down on your ditch system. But if you haven't been out here for a while, there's a million people that are going to move between Boulder and Fort Collins and Greeley up there. So a lot of that CBT water, the Big Thompson water, is actually now owned by the cities, not by the farmers up there.
That's interesting. Yeah. The one other comment I have is that I would watch that people grow corn out there, and then I came here, and it's just, why did he even try to grow anything there? I mean, just grow it here, you know, and use the water for something else there.
You know, one of our, you know, when we were in the drought in 2002, which was characterized as something as severe as we might see only once every 300 or 500 years, we actually had an alternative where we would pay farmers not to grow alfalfa hay out here. We would go to Iowa and buy hay there, bring it in for the cattle. If we could use your water in 2002 for domestic or human consumption, and it actually penciled out that it was cheaper for us to do that than some of the other alternatives. So, you know, you do crazy things at crazy times.
Sure, what you have to do. My wife had an interesting point on the whole place, and then I'll get off. But she said that we ought to mow down all the cities in the Midwest and move everybody out to the Front Range, and don't let them farm out on the Front Range. And use this land for nothing but farming here, you know, and everybody be living in the sunshine out there all winter, you know.
Well, we have that same issue here in Colorado. 80% of the water is over on the west slope, more over towards Utah, and 80% of the people are over here. And so one of the tensions we have, it's kind of like you have with the Great Lakes. Nobody wants that water to go south out of or across the divide into the Mississippi Basin. We have the same thing with Continental Divide. There is an ethic of not one drop will come from the west slope over to the Front Range. So we have all the people turning up in all the wrong places from a water management standpoint.
You know, it seems I listen to talk shows on the station, and it seems to me all the problems of the whole world, there's too many people. We have too many people. If we would cut the population in half, we could solve all these problems.
It sounds like you're advocating a social reengineering of the world. I'm not too, that's beyond my pay grade.
Right. Well, thanks for the call. We appreciate it. You know, one of the things that people can look at on your website the website of the Drought Mitigation Center, you can look at the drought monitor. And what that is, it's a map of the United States, and it shows the areas that are most severely affected.
Right.
And if you take a look at we have some areas of Southern California and Arizona where there is extreme drought. Some of the Rocky Mountain West there is certainly in severe drought. The place where it's the worst, where it's considered to be exceptional, and people certainly have heard a lot about this because it's got coverage, has been in the Southeast. Generally speaking, is it possible to talk about what causes droughts, or do you have to say, well, it depends, and from depending upon what, you know, year to year and what regions we're talking about, that the causes are going to be different?
Yeah, that's exactly right, David. It depends where you are, how you get your water. Is it wintertime precipitation, summer precipitation? A lot of it depends on the storm track. And, for example, the Southeast this year just was not in the storm track that brought in that moisture off the Gulf of Mexico or the Atlantic Ocean. And so it really depends where you are and the type of year, and the setup in the Pacific also plays a role.
If I might just add,
yes.
You know, what we're looking at is what's happening in the Pacific Ocean at the moment. You know, we see a lot of the precursors to the drought that we had in 1977. We have a La Nina condition. We see that where the storm track is. November is our second snowiest month, and I'm looking out the window today at maybe a half inch of snow. To us, that's an indication that not in 2008, but in 2009, we could be setting ourselves up for a drought again. So, I think the information that Michael and his group puts together is a good early warning for us from the water management standpoint, because I'll be making decisions on how I operate my mountain reservoirs based on, you know, these large weather pattern trends that we're seeing out there.
Well, Dr. Hayes, can you say anything about the patterns, precip patterns that we have seen, let's say maybe over the last decade, and whether is it trending drier?
That's a great question. This recent period of kind of an increase in drought frequency probably started about 1999, and we've had quite a bit of the United States in drought since then. But the causes of some of that dryness have certainly been different. We had an El Nino one year and then a La Nina another year, and each of those has different implications on the dryness. I guess if you look back in time, and I'm sure Aurora has done this in pretty good detail, and you look at tree ring studies and so forth, multiple year droughts and have extended into decades in some cases. And so, that we might be in a period of higher frequency of drought, but I don't think it's anything that unusual from what's happened on in the past.
Nothing.
And so I'd start that, and maybe Peter wants to add something to what I've said.
We do look at what has happened in the past, and up until 2002, we were using the drought of 1954, 55, 56 as the stress condition we put on our water supply systems. But if we look back over the hundreds of years of tree ring surveys, we see that there were more extended, more severe droughts. It happens that the infrastructure we built was based on a recent, relatively benign drought, and that's why we get into these water restriction programs, kind of like what Atlanta is going through at the moment. We built something that was good enough, but it's not great enough to withstand everything that we've seen from a climate standpoint. But we have seen a definite drying out in the last 6 or 7 years, as Michael was indicating. And at the moment, our indication is this is just an average condition that we're in now. It's not as severe as what we could anticipate.
Yeah. All right. Well, we have a couple of other callers here. Just real quick, I want to introduce again our guests. Peter Binney, he is the director of Aurora Water. That's the third largest municipal water provider in Colorado. And Dr. Michael Hayes is the director of the National Drought Mitigation Center based at the School of Natural Resources at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. And we're talking about water management and drought issues, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And we have some callers here to bring into the conversation. Somebody calling from Effingham. We'll go there. Line 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Thanks for taking my call. Very interesting program. Someone who has lived out in Breckenridge, Colorado 25 years ago, I'm guessing I probably, given the shift in population, probably would not even recognize the area. But I know Aurora very well in Denver, and I think, unfortunately, Colorado's damned by being so beautiful and people wanting to move out there and live. I don't see the population going down anytime soon, and I think this is probably just the beginning of a serious demand on very limited water. I know that if you're responsible for the snowfall in the Rockies for the impact on your water, and you don't get enough snow, not only are the ski resorts going to be hurting, but you're really going to be devastated with your water table come spring and summer. A couple of months ago, maybe a few months ago, David had somebody on his program. I just found this fascinating. And talking about water usage, and they said today the biggest water user in Florida are the golf courses. And I just think that we need as a nation to turn our thoughts around to get away from those kinds of activities if so many other people are going hurting just for regular usage of water. And I was hoping maybe you guys could comment on that. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, if I could, I mean, the largest water user here in Colorado is irrigation. 90% plus of the water that we use here in the state is for irrigated agriculture. And about 60% of that is used for growing hay, alfalfa, and grasses for the cattle industry. The solutions that we have here in Colorado are reflective of the public policy and how we want to use our water. I'd love to find a way to get Florida's water up here off their golf courses or Las Vegas golf courses to meet our needs in the Front Range. But you're right. I mean, I think we're getting to the point now where we're, it's not so much the development of water, because there is no more water out there, and, what we do have is subject to climate variability. But, we're getting to a stage now where we can't build any more reservoirs, because there's no more water to put in. It's already spoken for. So we're looking in the West now at a period of how do we reallocate water from whether it's golf courses or marginal farmlands and use that to the urban economies that are developing here. I mean, something, in the metropolitan area, nearly three quarters of our state's economy comes out of an urban-centric economy, yet we use 90% of our water for agriculture, which produces 2% of the state's economy. So the debate we have going on out here is, should we use this valuable resource when it has nominal economic value, but it's got high public and social value? I mean, people respect rural America. They respect the rights of the farmers who develop this water first, but there is an active market out here where some of that water is moving to the cities. So, you know, the market is talking. We are seeing a shifting of water. That will be a part of how we meet our future needs, whether it's drought resilience or to meet the needs of the next million people who are on their way. And, you know, that's just a period we're going through. We don't build dams. We move water between existing uses.
And may I add something, David?
Sure.
Just to follow on Peter's point, you know, we're really talking about people's livelihoods. And when you talk about golf courses and so forth, people run those golf courses, and so it's a business. And so when you point fingers like that, you're going to affect people's livelihoods and so forth. So in Georgia, they had a drought back about 2000, and we were down there and helping them out. And people started pointing fingers, and again, golf courses were singled out. Well, when people started looking at the numbers and understanding the importance to the economy of the golf courses in Georgia, the amount of water they really did use, and so forth, people then began to have a greater appreciation for something like golf courses in that area.
Yeah, and I think you're seeing the same thing in Atlanta at the moment. I mean, you know, the Atlanta problem is part a result of an endangered species issue. It's you know, maintaining flows for the environment downstream, and you know, so you're draining upper Georgia to meet the needs of an environmental need in lower Georgia and Florida. You've got an issue between Alabama and Florida. You know, so you know, what we did is we put a lot of limiting constraints on how we manage our water, you know, which reflected the values at the time. Here in Colorado, our value was irrigated agriculture in the 1800s. You know, so now it may be more that we want to have golf courses, or we want to have cities and people in cities, and as opposed to irrigated agriculture, some irrigated agriculture. So that's a big part of what we deal with out here is, you know, what is the value we're trying to reflect and how we use our water.
And droughts are different from other natural hazards. A lot of times after a tornado strikes a community or so forth, the community comes together and really bands together and works to repair the community. Droughts, when you've got this limiting water resource, the tendency is start to point fingers and say, well, look at how they're using water and so forth, kind of as Peter was describing. And so that's one of the things that we really need to work with as we're dealing with droughts, is trying to get the different groups to come together and talk and appreciate what they do and how what their livelihood is.
All right. Let's talk with someone else. This is a caller in Belgium, not too far away from here. Line number two. Hello.
Hello. Good morning. I'd like to recount a little episode of my life that took place in the Big Thompson Canyon. I think it was back in 1976 in about July. About midnight, I'm up in Estes Park, and I'm getting ready to go back to where I live in Broomfield.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm coming down the canyon, just, it's pouring rain, like you cannot believe. It's coming down where you cannot see your hood ornament. And we get to the bottom of the hill, my wife and I, and we get home, and we hear that just immediately after we came down that canyon, there was an enormous flood that killed many, many, many people.
Yeah, about 130, 140 people.
Yes. And we missed it by just moments, as far as I could tell. And we went back up, maybe about a few days later, to go back up to see the people we knew. And when we got up there, there was no water left. Mm-hmm. It was amazing. The water came down. I mean, it was a huge torrent, and it was gone.
Mm-hmm.
It had gone out into the Great Plains or wherever it goes. And the people here in the Midwest don't realize how fast that water disappears in the dry upper plains, or whatever you want to call that, front range. It just so amazed us how fast that water came down, and then it was gone.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously very dangerous. I think what happened was some small dams broke up above the Great Thompson Dam they're talking about.
Most of that came from the fact that there was about 12 to 14 inches of rain right at the head of the watershed, and it all got funneled down through that canyon that you were incredibly lucky to get through when you did.
Because you can't believe.
I mean, the road is, just 10 feet or so above the creek, but, 30 to 40 feet high wall of water went down through there and tragically caught a lot of people in their cars trying to get down out of the canyon. But
yes, and a lot of people who were camping and all kinds of things. I guess the water really started up there in Estes Park where it was raining like you cannot believe. I mean, you'd see that in the tropics, but you don't very rarely see it there.
Yes.
Probably, thankfully.
Yes.
And it went around into Loveland, and I don't know where the water went, but it was gone within 3 or 4 days. It was just dry ground again.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it went down into the South Platte, then down into the North Platte and the Missouri system. But that's, representative of what we have out here, as I mentioned earlier on. All of our water for water supplies comes in May and June, and we capture that in the lakes and the reservoirs up on the divide, and then we let it flow down to meet our needs. But, they have a saying around here that whiskey is for drinking and water is for fighting, and, it's loosely attributed to Mark Twain, but, that's how we make our public policy decisions around here. It's very confrontational, very adversarial, and very positional.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thanks for the call. I'd like to ask Peter Binney. I think that it is true that around the country people are being encouraged to at least be more conscious of how they use water, and I think the ultimate goal is to get people to reduce their water use. Now, you can do, obviously, one way to do that is by making it more expensive. Do you think that there are other ways, maybe better ways to get people to be more conscious of their use and then be more efficient in their use of water?
Mm-hmm. There are. We're becoming more conscious of that within the house. On our system, and I think this is typical around the country, people use around 50 to 60 gallons per capita, per person, per day. With the types of plumbing appliances that we use, plus some customer behavior patterns, we can typically reduce that, 10%. For us, the biggest area of opportunity is in outdoor water use. So we use about half of our water to water our lawns out here. And one of the things we're looking at is how do we design our communities? Do we go vertical and have multi-story development as opposed to horizontal? I mean, here you can build houses, till the cows come home. Land is not the constraint, but maybe we need to start building our communities not on quarter-acre lots or fifth-acre lots, but cluster them and have open common space areas to be more respectful of water use. I think the area of greatest opportunity for us is to use Xeriscape, get people to plant the yards more in a desert environment as opposed to an area like the country where you are, where you don't need irrigation systems, or if you do, they're used very infrequently. So I think there's a lot of opportunity where we don't presume that water is always going to be there, but we take a stronger role in saying that it is a limiting resource. We have to be more respectful of it and, build communities that are going to use less water. It's very similar to the issue we're going through from an energy standpoint. Do we use more fuel-efficient cars? Do we use more water-efficient communities? And I think there's a lot of opportunity there that we should be looking at.
All right, let's talk with another caller here in Arcola. This is line one. Hello.
Yes, I was calling. I live in Douglas County, which is one of the sites for the Future Gen power station, where they're going to clean up the coal, sequester the pollution underground. And my question is, what is your view on the possibility of polluting the Mahomet Aquifer by doing this? Thank you.
All right. I don't know if that's Dr. Hayes. Is that a question you can answer?
I don't understand the geology of how the aquifer would be exist there in Illinois. So I can't directly answer that question.
Yeah, I think it's probably we would have to get somebody from our somebody from the Illinois State Water Survey would have to answer that question.
Absolutely, but it's an issue that you have to think about and certainly be concerned about is what is the interaction between what goes on at the surface and what takes place in aquifers.
Mm-hmm. Has that? I know this is the kind of thing that people are looking at other places. This idea that coal to manage to use that resource to generate energy, but not contribute to global warming, to take the carbon dioxide instead of it going into the atmosphere, injecting it down into the ground. Is there concerns about that affecting water supplies? Are there anywhere that people are looking at that, or is this the thing that you just have to say? Well, I've got to know what the geology of the place is before I can really say much to you about that.
I would think so. I mean, the big issue that is out there is more on the brines, the chlorides in the brines that, you know, come through energy production and reinjecting those. That is a big issue from a contamination of near surface aquifers. It's a heavily regulated program. The federal government has injection criteria that are used to protect the water resources. I'm always very skeptical about the idea of using a natural resource system like that and putting pollution back in. If you ever want to recover it as a water supply, it's a lot more difficult, to deal with. We saw that from a Superfund standpoint and from a chloride brine management standpoint from coal methane development. But it is very site-specific. But, it's not without its problems, that's for sure.
Okay. Well, again, I think that means for us here on this program, sometime soon we need to do a water issues program that is specific to us right here, to mm-hmm. our part of the state. And I know that we can get some people in here and do that. So we'll try and do that. Otherwise, questions are welcome here. We have about 10 minutes, actually a little bit less in this part of Focus 580. And again, let me introduce our guests, Peter Binney. He is director of Aurora Water. This is the third largest municipal water provider in the state of Colorado, serves over 300,000 people. Aurora is a suburb of Denver. And then also joining us by telephone is Michael Hayes. He is director of the National Drought Mitigation Center that's based in the School of Natural Resources at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln. And questions welcome. We're talking here about water management and particularly about drought issues. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I want to turn back here to Dr. Hayes and give you the chance to talk a little bit about mitigation. And I guess I would think that other than doing everything that you can to get people to reduce their water use, so to reduce and be more efficient, so that you make the best use of the water that you have, what you can do in terms of mitigation. I would think that drought is just something that kind of happens to you and you just have to get through it.
That's a good question. I think there are some less obvious aspects of mitigation that people don't often think about. Mm-hmm. One of those is improving our monitoring system of where is the water and how are we using that water. And so an improvement in our climate monitoring system, our stream gauge network, soil moisture network is needed across the country. So improving monitoring capabilities of water and climate are going to be very important, and that's a great mitigation strategy that people need to think about, as well as just planning ahead and having a plan in place when they do go through a drought situation is very important. And that's a great mitigation strategy as well. So it helps in your response during an event, but having it in place before an event is a great mitigation strategy.
Mm. Did Peter, have there been cases where there in your area you put in mandatory limits on how much water people were using?
Yes. Yeah.
You did.
In 2002 and 2003, we had to, we had two programs. One was on use and, we actually have a program in place, which is, it's a little bit like the TSA's color-coded map, and as you go further into these droughts, we have increasing mandatory levels of restrictions on what people can do, mm-hmm. all the way up to the point where you'd have to shut off outdoor watering and, you know, just be on a lifeline consumption. But we also did get to the point of considering shutting down taps for new development until the drought had passed or we had additional supplies.
All right. Let's talk with someone in Danville here, line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Just an interesting comment and then a question. We sail and we have a water maker on our boat, and there are two of us, and we do really quite nicely without, you know, our extravagant water use is 20 gallons a day between the two of us, and when we really work at it, we can get well below 10 and be comfortable. Obviously, people aren't going to do that, but if you add water-saving toilets and waterless urinals and perennial plants rather than lawns and all those kinds of things, are there some numbers on what kind of reduction of overall use household can do it with reasonable conservation? And, do you think the last thing is, do you think it's going to take regulation to do that, or are we just going to keep running ourselves out of water until we have to regulate, or are there some discussions about voluntarily the possibility of that actually happening?
Okay. A fair question, and when I go sailing, I sure enjoy getting to port and having a hot shower on land. I've also survived on 10 gallons per capita per day, but somebody keeps putting a liquid in a can that I use to supplement that 10 gallons. What they find... In an unrestricted use in the city, we deliver around 60 gallons per person per day. So I'll say that's the unrestricted use. We can get it down to around 35 to 40 under public education advisories, strong recommendations on voluntary reductions, and those are things like use high efficiency washers, don't run your clothes washer until you have a full load of laundry, limit your showers to 2 to 3 minutes, don't run the water while you're brushing your teeth. All of those can take you from the 60 down to a 35. Anything less than 35, though, seems to be a major lifestyle change that people have to make before you can get down to that level, like sailing boats and things like that. Unfortunately, we do see that the public system responds most effectively to crisis as opposed to preemptive planning and investment. And, I'm seeing that whether it's in transportation or water supplies. But in this community, we did decide that we're going to try to get ahead of that. We're spending $750 million on a project to address this need for the next 20 to 30 years. But that was a tough thing for our local politicians to support, given that most of them were term limited, and it required a lot of resolve for them to say that they're going to leave that as their legacy so future generations won't be in the crisis that we had over the last few years.
Does that, and is the caller still there? Does it get at your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you very
much. All right, thanks. I'm impressed with your 60-gallon per person per day average water use there in Aurora. It seems to me isn't that significantly less than what the national average is?
Well, 60 gallons is for indoor use. We add about 100 gallons per day throughout the year to keep our lawns green.
Oh, so 160, yeah. So that really probably is more like what the national average is.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we're right in line with the national for areas that have the kind of precipitation we have. No, that was just for in the house use.
I see. Okay. So I guess, what the person was talking about was for personal use for things like washing and so forth, and not so much what we might be putting on our lawns, or for that matter, I guess, using to wash clothes and so forth.
Yeah.
That gets back to the question about how does you get people to change their minds about things, and how are you doing anything specific there to try to persuade people that they really don't need to have a green lawn like people here maybe have?
We have a program that's not as aggressive as what they have in Las Vegas, which is loosely called the Cash for Grass program. Out there, they're paying $2 per square foot for people to rip up their backyards to reduce the demand. We have about $500,000 that we've set aside for people to move from Kentucky bluegrass to more of a xeriscape landscaping, mm-hmm. you know, which is really just very low-density shrub beds, you know, a lot lower water use on our system. So, you know, we're trying to get people to be more respectful of the fact they live in a desert environment. But I think that the biggest place that we'll have an impact is when we work with our politicians and land developers and our community to make these communities look different. You know, it won't be the, you know, the cookie-cutter grid that we have of houses all over the plains, but rather high-density development around common areas and reduce water consumption that way.
Well, here we're about to have to finish up. Dr. Hayes, any last quick thoughts you might like to leave with folks?
I just want to follow up on what Peter was saying. You know, education is extremely important, and you have to work on changing the perceptions and the culture of a region. And I think the West is working on that. And I think the situation that we're seeing currently in the Southeast shows that it's going to be needed in the Southeast, the East Coast, the Great Lakes as well. So hopefully we're moving in that direction, and we can learn from some of the things like what's going on in Aurora right now.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there with our thanks to our guests, Michael Hayes. He's director of the National Drought Mitigation Center that's based in the School of Natural Resources at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. And they have a website there that has a lot of information about drought. So if you'd like to learn more, you go to www.drought.unl.edu. And also with us, Peter Binney. He's director of Aurora Water. It's the third largest municipal water provider in the state of Colorado. And you'd like to find out about them, or maybe you'd like to learn about Aurora, you can go to www.auroragov.org. And to you, Mr. Binney, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Dr. Hayes, thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
Okay. Thanks to you and your listeners.
Great. Thank you.